Iran has officially begins the registration process for volunteers for the country's 13th presidential election to be held on June 18th. At least 9 people are killed in a shooting at a high school in the central Russian city of Kazan. And also on our headlines, 24 Palestinians, including 9 children, are killed in Israeli overnight attacks on the Gaza Strip. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half-hour: Iran has officially begun the registration process of hopefuls for the country's 13th presidential election. The registration kicked off at the Interior Ministry building Tuesday and will run for 5 days. Afterwards, the names of those registered will be handed over to the Constitutional Council. That's the body in charge of vetting candidates for any election in Iran. The Constitutional Council is expected to release the final list of approved candidates for the presidential election at the end of this month. Iranians will go to the polls on June 18th to choose a successor to incumbent president Hassan Rouhani. More than 59 million people are eligible to cast their ballots. Correspondent Houman Abedi explains what qualifications are required for the Iranian hopefuls to run for president.
You know, today is the first day of this registration, and it will go on for 5 days. I mean, until May 15th, this process would continue, and after that, it would be the duty or responsibility of the Guardian Council to vet the hopefuls for the upcoming elections. The difference of this round from the previous ones is that for this round, the Guardian Council has announced some new rules and some necessities for the hopefuls when they are registering. They have to be over 40 years old. They shouldn't be over 75 years old. They have to have political backgrounds at least for 4 years. And in the previous rounds of presidential elections of Iran, military people could not take part in the elections. But according to the new regulations that the Guardian Council announced to the Interior Ministry, right now the military people could also run for the president. Of course, those who have been, in the position of a major general.
EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell describes efforts to save the Iran nuclear deal as an extremely delicate and sensitive process. The bloc's top diplomat has been discussing the topic with EU Foreign Affairs Ministers in Brussels. Jerome News reports from the Belgian capital.
A lot of work is needed and time is limited. That's what Josep Borrell, the EU's foreign policy chief, has told a ministerial meeting in Brussels with respect to ongoing talks in Vienna to try and save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal.
It's an effort to make the US to go back to the agreement in order to have a full compliance for Iran, which is the best way to ensure the exclusively peaceful nature of Iran nuclear program.
Tehran insists it has zero ambition to build a nuclear bomb. The idea that Iran wants a nuclear weapon is peddled by Tel Aviv and the Israel lobby in the US, according to unbiased security experts.
Where is the evidence, they ask? How many times has Washington launched attacks on foreign nations without any justification?
Critics say the West's meddling in the Middle East has caused immeasurable damage.
Well, the biggest failing of all was the, intervention of the United States into Iraq, after 9/11, because this created a security vacuum.
EU and US foreign policy was recently debated in the European Parliament.
We must work for stability in Iran and Iraq and Lebanon, a peace in Syria and Yemen, and oppose the US-Saudi attempts to isolate Iran.
The Iran nuclear agreement, underpinned by the UN, was thrown into flux when Donald Trump pulled the US out of the accord 3 years ago this month. He then imposed harsh, illegal economic sanctions on Iran. Saving the nuclear deal would help to bring stability to the region, it has been suggested.
You know, Middle East, it is a vital area. We should to make it a quiet area because, you know, it is on the middle of the trade road, so it will affect all the economy situation in all the world.
Joseph Borrell has told EU Foreign Affairs Ministers the talks in Vienna, Austria are extremely delicate, sensitive and intense. He says he's optimistic and a window of opportunity will stay open until the end of this month. Nothing is agreed until everything is agreed, he insists. Jerome Hughes, Press TV, Brussels.
At least 9 people have been killed in a shooting at a high school in the central Russian city of Kazan. Russian media say the dead include a teacher and 8 school children. At least 4 people have been hospitalized as well. Reports say there was an explosion following the shooting at the school. Some Russian news agencies say 2 teenage gunmen were involved. Others say only 1 was involved. They say 1 gunman has been detained. It was not immediately clear what the motive for the attack was. 3 Palestinians, including a woman, have been killed in the latest Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. The strikes hit an apartment in the western Gaza city. The latest deaths bring to 24 the number of people killed in the Gaza Strip since Israel launched airstrikes there Monday. 9 children are among those killed. Scores have been wounded as well. Meanwhile, 2 factories have been damaged in the north and east of the besieged territory. In response to the aggression, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has fired rockets into Israel. Israeli media say 7 people have been injured after a rocket hit the city of Ashkelon. The ongoing wave of violence broke out after Israel launched a crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Zasha Shannon gives us the latest from Gaza as Israel continues airstrikes there.
The Israeli regime forces continued to pound the Gaza Strip throughout the night, killing over 22 Palestinians and around 110 others were injured. There's still conflicting reports about the number of fatalities. It's between 22 and 24 regarding the number of fatalities in the Gaza Strip. This while Palestinian resistance fighters, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, have been firing volleys of rockets towards the Israeli regime. The Palestinians have fired at least 250 rockets and projectiles towards the Israeli regime. It's a habit of the Israelis not to release the number of casualties or injuries. Whole escalation resulted. It was a result of the ongoing Israeli attacks and violations against Palestinians in Jerusalem, of course, and Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza felt that they will not leave the brethren and the occupied Muslim city behind, so they decided to press through with their firing of rockets. To force the Israeli regime to ease the attacks and ease the siege on the worshippers and the occupied city of Jerusalem al-Quds.
Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian protesters at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds. Israeli troops fired rubber bullets and stun grenades at worshippers inside the mosque. The protesters responded by throwing rocks and other objects. The Israeli violence at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound has left more than 700 Palestinians injured. Medics say some of those wounded have lost eyes after being hit with rubber bullets. In the West Bank city of Bethlehem, troops fired tear gas at people protesting in solidarity with Al-Quds worshippers. Israeli forces also attacked protesters at Qalandia checkpoint near Ramallah. The violence has sparked over the looming evictions of several Palestinian families from their homes in Jerusalem al-Quds and Israeli restrictions for Muslims during the fasting month of Ramadan. Iran's foreign ministers lashed out at Israel for its crackdown on Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif blamed Israel for stealing people's land and homes and creating an apartheid regime. Zarif said Israel shot innocent worshippers inside Islam's third holiest site before Eid al-Fitr that marks the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has also denounced Israel's actions, vowing to mobilize the world to stop what he called the Israeli terror and occupation. Thousands of pro-Palestinian protesters also rallied across Turkey to denounce the Israeli violence in Jordan. Thousands of protesters took to the streets to call on their government to scrap its peace deal with Israel in the face of its crackdown around Al-Aqsa Mosque. Protesters held signs and chanted slogans while marching toward the Israeli embassy in Amman. Riot police blocked roads leading to the fortified embassy complex. Meanwhile, prominent rights group Amnesty International has condemned the Israeli violence, calling for an end to what it called brutal repression of Palestinian protesters. Several countries, including Germany, France, and the United States, called on both sides to show restraint. Also in Iran, protesters in the capital Tehran slammed the Israeli violation of Palestinians' rights, including the planned eviction of Palestinians from their homes in a neighborhood in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds.
No more silence. Say a word. Pro-Palestine activists gathered outside the UN office in Tehran to demand that the United Nations take action with regards to Israel's expulsion of Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah and other areas in East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Mostly student, the protesters called the Israeli move barbaric and against all international laws.
I'm here to support Palestinian rights. As for the recent crimes against humanity, these aren't recent. These have been around for a long time. It's more than, what, nearly 70, 75 years that the ethnic cleansing of Palestine has been an ongoing process. This needs to stop. And more people need to stand up to Israel and to the crimes that they're committing. We need to talk about this and we need to stop this.
We have come here to voice our solidarity with and support to our brothers and sisters in Palestine and to condemn the inhumane behavior of the Israeli regime against Palestinians. We regard the UN silence as complicity in the crimes committed by Israel.
Israeli forces have over the past days been attacking Palestinian homes in East Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, trying to force the Palestinians to abandon their residences in an attempt to make way for the construction of new illegal settlements. The regime has so far wounded dozens of Palestinians protesting against the decision made by an Israeli court.
During the past days, we have witnessed heinous crimes against the innocent Palestinian people by Israel. It's interesting that the U.S. claims to be the defender of human rights. I wonder, why is Joe Biden keeping mum and not condemning the Israeli violence? Where did all the human rights slogans go?
Israel has for 7 decades been pressing ahead with the construction of illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories and continues to deny millions of Palestinian refugees the right to return. Several attempts have been made to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the last of which was the so-called deal of the century, proposed by ex-US President Donald Trump, which is dismissed by Palestinians as an attempt to trade their identity and history with money.
Rights activists here say Israel's recent atrocities are a proof that the so-called peace plans by the West cannot defend the rights of Palestinians and will only make the Israeli regime more insolent in its crimes in Palestine. Protesters say it's time to take action, as any silence by the international community is tantamount to a green light to Israel's violence against Palestinians. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
India's 7-day average of new coronavirus cases has reached a record high of nearly 391,000. The country is also leading the world in the daily average number of new deaths. It accounts for 1 in every 3 deaths reported worldwide each day. India's new daily infections were almost 330,000 on Tuesday. Its new deaths were above 3,800. Both figures slightly decreased from recent record highs. India has the world's second largest caseload. With almost 23 million infections, the country is grappling with a severe health crisis caused by a COVID surge in the past several weeks. The surge is partly blamed on a new strain, which the World Health Organization says is classified as a variant of global concern. Moving on, the Taliban militant group has announced a nationwide ceasefire that will take effect when the 3-day Eid al-Fitr holiday begins on Thursday. This comes after weeks of increasing violence that has gripped the country. Our Kabul-based correspondent Amir Alimi has more for us.
According to the spokesperson of Taliban, The group's leadership has ordered all members to stop fighting during the 3 days of Eid al-Fitr that mark the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan.
Taliban also say the group's leader has ordered all members not to enter government-controlled areas during the 3-day ceasefire and that they would not allow government troops to get into Taliban-controlled areas in the same period.
The declaration of 3-day ceasefire by the Taliban has been widely welcomed in Afghanistan. Locals who are bearing the brunt of violence say they expect the Taliban to agree to a permanent ceasefire in the hopes that it would lead the country to a lasting peace.
Nonetheless, we welcome the 3-day ceasefire by the Taliban, but I think temporary ceasefires are not viable long-term options to put an end to our misery. So we want the Taliban to approve a lasting ceasefire instead of insisting on war.
Taliban approved the 3-day ceasefire as Afghanistan witnessed a sharp increase in civilian deaths due to rising terrorist attacks such as car bombs or explosions over the recent months. On Saturday, 3 separate heavy explosions went off close to a girls' school in western Kabul. 68 civilians were killed, most of them young girls. Also, over 160 others were wounded in the incident. This grim attack occurred just 2 days before the Taliban militant group declared the Eid ceasefire. Meanwhile, Menahar called on international players to put pressure on the Taliban to approve a permanent ceasefire.
The ceasefire is good news for us, but our oppressed people deserve lasting calm and security as they have tolerated a decades-long bloody war. Therefore, some foreign states who had promised us to bring peace in our country must fulfill their obligation.
This is not the first time the Taliban approves a short-term ceasefire since it was removed from power back in 2001. In June 2018, the Taliban approved a 3-day ceasefire. During that period, some Taliban militants entered Kabul and even took photos by Afghan armed troops. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Well, that's a wrap for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
in the limelight.
America's security state has become so much corrupted under presidents of both parties, says Andrew P. Napolitano, author, in an article published under the heading, More U.S. Government Spying and Lying. Stay tuned for more. Recently, the U.S. federal government's unconstitutional spying on ordinary Americans was exposed. One of these revelations was made by a federal judge in Washington, D.C., who wrote that the FBI is still using warrantless spying in criminal cases, notwithstanding the Constitution and federal laws. The other revelation was a surprise even to those of Americans who monitor these things. The United States Postal Service acknowledged that it has been spying on Americans. Here is a backstory. The modern American security state, the parts of the federal government that spy on Americans and do not change on account of elections, received an enormous shot in the arm in 1978 when Congress enacted the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. That naively misguided and profoundly unconstitutional law was sold to Congress as a way to control the security state's spying in the aftermath of Watergate. Watergate had revealed that President Richard Nixon used the FBI and the CIA to spy on real and imagined domestic political adversaries. FISA set up a secret court that authorized domestic spying by issuing warrants not based on probable cause of crime, as the Constitution requires, but on probable cause of communicating with foreign agents. Never mind that communications about non-criminal matters are protected speech. The FISA court issued tens of thousands of these warrants. As the security state's appetite for spying grew more voracious, its agents and lawyers persuaded the FISA court to lower the bar for issuing a surveillance warrant from communicating with a foreign agent to communicating with a foreign person, and to expand the scope of those warrants to include Americans who have communicated with other Americans who have communicated with foreign people. Jealous of the ease with which America's spies can obtain warrants from the FISA court, the FBI persuaded its friends on Capitol Hill to enact legislation that gives the FBI a peek at data the security state gathers if it meets certain standards to see if any of it pertains to criminal matters. Each one of these FBI peeks at raw intelligence data is known as a share. All of this was done in utter disregard of the Fourth Amendment's requirements that no search warrants shall be issued without showing under oath probable cause of crime, and that all warrants shall specifically describe the place to be searched and the person or thing to be seized. If an FBI agent sees evidence of a non-national security crime on one of the shares, the agent will try to use it in a criminal prosecution, even though he required in it the violation of the Fourth Amendment. If federal prosecutors want to introduce evidence from the share at trial, they need to find another source for it, as no judge will admit raw intelligence data obtained without a warrant in a criminal case. After 9/11, President George W. Bush ordered the National Security Agency, the 60,000-person-strong branch of the military that quarterbacks domestic spying, to capture every keystroke on every computer and the contents of every phone call in America. All presidents since Bush, even President Donald Trump, who was personally victimized by this spying, have continued the practice of universal, suspicionless, warrantless spying. The NSA sharing data with the FBI is deeply troubling because it violates both the Fourth Amendment and the federal law. The intentional use of FISA to obtain data about an American for non-national security-related criminal activity is itself a criminal act, as it constitutes a planned and direct violation of the Fourth Amendment by the electronic means, otherwise known as hacking. Recently, the chief judge of the FISA court revealed that for 2019, the FBI reported just one instance of sharing, even though Department of Justice auditors found 91 instances. And that matter is far lower than the true number of shares since, inexplicably, the DOJ counts all shares performed by one agent as one share, even though the agent may have accessed the data of more than one American. In August 2019, one FBI agent accessed the raw intelligence data of 16,000 Americans in order to find criminal evidence about seven of them. The FBI reported that as one share. Also recently, the USPS revealed that its postal inspectors have been monitoring social media at random, looking for troublemakers. Since social media is publicly posted, people can read it at will. But the Fourth Amendment requires that the government have articulate suspicion about the person whose social media is being surveilled before it begins its surveillance, even surveillance of publicly available materials. This is to prevent phishing expeditions. What articulable suspicions did the Postal Service have before its police began their surveillance? What conceivable threat to the postal mails is manifested in texts and emails, other than that the latter are infinitely faster and profoundly more efficient? None and none. All this shows just how corrupted America's security state has become under presence of both parties, from counting 16,000 as if it were one, to hacking the text and emails of people without articulable suspicion or probable cause, to orchestrating end runs around the Fourth Amendment, to lying to federal judges about all this. We see the tactics of the East German Stasi that has been reborn on this side of the Atlantic. Of what value is the constitutional guarantee of privacy if those Americans have hired to protect it are themselves undermining it?
The debate.
Israeli forces continue their attacks on Palestinians in and around Jerusalem outlets. Over 300 so far have been injured in days of Israeli aggression. Dallas and Mosque is again the flashpoint between Palestinians and Israel. In this edition of the debate, we will look at why this Ramadan Israeli forces have used such extreme force against Palestinians and the chances that this may result in a third intifada. Joining us from occupied Ramallah is our correspondent, Mona Kandil, first, in order to get an update about what is going on there. Mona, at this point, we know that the latest involved Hamas and rockets that landed in Jerusalem. You can tell us about that, and around Jerusalem and in the southern part of Israel. Tell us what has occurred and unfortunate casualties that has arisen from that.
Well, that's right. Since the early hours of Monday, clashes have been taking place in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, on what's called Jerusalem Day. Palestinians remained in Jerusalem Al-Quds Al-Aqsa Mosque in order to defend it and to prevent settler raids. The Israeli forces attacked the Palestinian worshippers. We are speaking about more than 300 Palestinians were wounded during these clashes. In the afternoon hours, Hamas movement, the resistance groups had threatened Israel that it would launch rocket fire due to the ongoing clashes in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and what happened is that shortly after 6 p.m., seven rockets were fired towards Jerusalem from the Gaza Strip. Following the rocket fire, Israeli Air Force carried out several strikes against the Gaza Strip, killing a number of Palestinians. Nine Palestinians were killed in the Gaza Strip, including three children. Now, the Israeli military also issued another statement warning Hamas that all options, including a ground operation, were on the table after dozens of rockets fired from the Gaza Strip at the time where thousands of Israeli settlers were parading through Jerusalem, Al-Quds, to celebrate Jerusalem Day. This day when the Israeli authorities occupied the eastern part of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and annexed it to Israel. At the moment, hundreds of Palestinians are planning to take part in a demonstration that would be heading to Columbia military checkpoint in order to express their solidarity and their refusal of the ongoing Israeli crimes against the Palestinians, not only in Jerusalem Al-Quds, but now the crimes that are being committed against the people of Gaza Strip, especially after the warning and the threats that are coming from the Israeli military establishment.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Mona Kandil from Occupied Ramallah giving us the latest. Let's bring in author at Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire, Richard Becker, who joins us from San Francisco. Richard Becker, welcome. We're looking at violence and attacks from Israeli forces against Palestinians. Rather brutal and extreme. I'm sure you've probably seen some of those scenes. Why do you think there's such a harsh treatment against Palestinians, which at this point has resulted in over 300 injuries? And, of course, we've had the rocket attacks coming from the Gaza Strip, and then Israel retaliating and nine people to have been killed there.
Well, you can see that this is a very powerful movement among the Palestinians that is going on right now, and one that is somewhat different than what we've seen in the recent period, in that Palestinians from the West Bank, of course, from East Jerusalem, from Gaza, have joined together, but also there's been a very strong presence of Palestinians from inside the 1948 borders of Israel. And this is something that is taken as very significant, I think, in Washington, D.C., as well as in the capital of Jordan, and in other capitals around the world, particularly those that are closely tied into this to the issues that are going on there. So this is something where the United States, I believe, is even behind the scenes telling the Israelis, to go slower. At least these are the reports, and not so heavy-handed in their repression. But that has not impacted the Israelis, and the Israeli government has unleashed its police in the most brutal ways against the Palestinians, and attacking, including firing grenades, flashbang grenades into the Al-Aqsa Mosque itself. So this is a very brutal repression against the people who are justifiably rising up against oppression, the terrible oppression that anyone who has been there and seeing with their own eyes can and knows just how brutal it is, and they are attempting to crush this uprising by the Palestinians, but it does not appear that they're successful in doing that.
All right, let me bring in Daniel Jejic from Beirut. He's an author and researcher who joins us. Daniel Jejic, welcome. Let's look at the U.S. response here, since our guests are mentioned it. You had the U.S. National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, encouraging Israel to pursue appropriate measures to ensure calm during Jerusalem Day commemorations. I mean, you're looking at over 800 Palestinians to have been injured, Israel police to have targeted rubber encased bullets directly at people's head. Three actually have lost one eye each. And you also had an Israeli driver who had rammed into Palestinians. Doesn't quite match the somewhat toned-down rhetoric coming from the U.S. on this.
Yeah, absolutely does not. I mean, the difference in power relations is obviously very clear. It is Israel that is initiating the violence and that is structurally oppressing Palestinians, which is very obvious in these latest so-called escalations of violence. So there is no way for Israel, which is the oppressor and the occupier and the colonizer, to be called to implement any sort of calm or restore any order, because it is initiating the violence and it necessitates the violence for its colonial project.
Richard Becker, if we want to take a look at the message that the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is sending in terms of the way that the Israeli security forces are waging this aggressiveness against Palestinians, what do you think that is? Because based on records, this is the worst violence seen since the year 2017. And throughout the past couple of years, scenes like this are just not, obviously not common. We take particular scenes shot by shot. You can see the way there's rage that's coming out. Palestinians reacting, of course, to the force that the Israeli forces are using on them.
Yeah, there's no question that what Netanyahu, who's a criminal himself, is doing, he is encouraging the police, this huge police force that is really organized around suppressing the Palestinian people, he's encouraging them to be even more brutal. And this is, you know, on the one hand, I think this is Netanyahu in another desperate attempt to get out of his own situation, his corruption trials and so forth. But it's also what the reality of Israel has meant, what the Israeli occupation has meant, and not just the occupation, but going all the way back to 1948. And we saw reports this week where Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister, the papers that were released, you know, to do everything, use all forms of brutality to get the Palestinian population to leave, to force them out, to make way for the state of Israel. That's continuing until today. And the Israeli state has no other answer to the Palestinians, because the reality, which most of the world understands, is that the land was stolen. The Palestinian land was stolen. And they have faced all kinds of brutality, ongoing brutality of the worst sort. Gaza is a giant open-air prison. The world knows this, but the United States and the other allies of the state of Israel and
Okay, Daniel, let me have you, if you can, break open this Al-Aqsa Mosque, what it represents, why Israel prevents Palestinians from actually praying inside the mosque, while you have settlers that go there, while you have even foreigners that go there, and yet Palestinians on their own land, they can't go into that mosque that they revere so much. I mean, give us some background to this, if you can.
Sure, it's a good question. I mean, first of all, I think Israel does it because of Israel's racist nature. It will obviously, in order to take the land, try anything in its power to separate the indigenous people from their indigenous land. The Al-Aqsa Mosque has a very particular importance in Islam in particular, and it also has a cultural importance being in Jerusalem, which is the capital of Palestine. So it does bear a very strong significance, but it is also at the same time in a area that is considered holy by all three monotheistic religions, which is why then, within the context of Israel and its Zionist supremacist character, it is, of course, Israel that wants to have the full control over not only Jerusalem, the city, but also over the whole East Side. And this is what is, I wouldn't say causing conflict, but it is a source of violence and has been for decades and has been initiated by the Israeli regime against Palestinians.
You have some Arab nations that have relationship with Israel, and then you have some new ones that are formally come out, even though behind the scenes it was said that they did have a relationship in what was called this normalization of ties that Israel and these couple Arab countries, such as Bahrain and the UAE. Do you think that that actually, in a sense, indirectly maybe, emboldens Israel to go ahead and feel like it could, not that it wasn't doing it before, but maybe just come out without any guilt, doing the you know, expanding on settlements, exercising all these different violations of Palestinian rights, from freedom of movement to you name it. Do you think that may be playing a factor in all of this?
Yeah, whereas I don't think that the Zionist regime knows the concept of guilt at all, I do think that probably the latest events of normalization might strengthen Israel and its position in the region, or at least its self-confidence in these perpetuations of violence, because when even before the normalization, several Arab governments have been rather passive towards the Zionist regime. And now Israel might feel more encouraged because it has close ties to these regimes that are, again, I would like to stress, not necessarily representative of the populations in these countries because they're not democratically elected. But it does, you know, help Israel, of course, to also to reframe what it's doing and to, on the one hand, use this rhetoric of an alleged peace that it has with Arab dictatorships, at the same time, of course, oppress Palestinians and use an Orientalist and anti-Arab rhetoric in order to justify all of these inhuman human rights violations and crimes that it's perpetuating on a daily basis.
If we have Richard Becker, I'd like to address this question to him. We're looking at two different vantage points, Richard, when it comes to the way that Palestinians are viewed and then Israelis are viewed, particularly the settlers. Now, for example, Israeli police have said that Jewish prayers continue as usual at the Western Wall, which adjoins the Esplanade, adding also that, quote, we will not let extremists threaten the safety of the public. Now, why do you think Palestinians by Israelis are viewed as extremists, yet Israelis are not? And settlers, for example, have been called extremists by many, but it's not, you know, the way that is portrayed is not that way.
No, reality has turned upside down in the Western media, in the media here. The Palestinians are presented as the aggressors, when in reality, especially among, but not exclusively, but especially among the settler movements, they're increasingly fascistic in their ideology and in their tactics and in their brutality. But this is really just a continuation. There's a kind of a continuum that has existed. In the beginning, there was a pretense that this was some kind of a socialist state or, you know, a liberal state in Israel, but it was a state created by the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Of 80% of the Palestinian population was driven out. 750,000 people were driven out. And in order to create the state, I mean, that can't be a liberal enterprise or a socialist enterprise. That can only be an extension of imperialism. And so we've seen this continue, and more now, the Israeli government, and this has been for decades in actuality, has given a green light to the settlers to carry out all sorts of violence against the Palestinian population. And if you see this and you go there and see it for yourself, or you see the videos, you see the soldiers, the Israeli soldiers, while the settlers attack and brutalize the Palestinians, stand by and watch until the Palestinians resist, and then the soldiers intervene as well. That's the reality on the ground in the West Bank, it's in Jerusalem. The Palestinians who live inside the 48 borders are second-class citizens and heavily discriminated against in every way and subject to brutality themselves. That's the reality.
Well, there's got to be a reality check that needs to be done. I'm guessing at this point, Daniel, for the U.S., in particular being the ally that it is for Israel. U.S. President Joe Biden has not had the Palestinian-Israel issue at the top of his agenda. He has not really said much. We know that during the campaign trail, he did approve of the way that Donald Trump, for example, handled the so-called normalization of ties. He thought that that was a good thing. But given what has happened now, I'm guessing this should move up a notch or even a lot more than that for it to have the attention of the Biden administration, will it?
I don't think so. I think U.S. support for Israel is something that is pre-political. It has been there for decades, regardless of whatever crime Israel commits, whether it shoots people, massacres them live on camera. I think what might have maybe created these discussions over U.S. support is that at times, like right now, today, certain events become more newsworthy and people talk about them more. And effectively, there has been an ethnic cleansing that's been ongoing for 73 years. And the most significant thing that a U.S. administration could do is to passively call for calm or a restoration of order, but I do not think that it will have any effect, especially also because Israel is a U.S. proxy in many ways, and is, as Biden himself has said some decades ago, if there wasn't Israel, the United States would have to invent it. So the so-called safety and security of the settler colonial project is what is vital to U.S. U.S. interest in the region, but also to a certain extent to the U.S. culture and identity as well.
Richard Bricker, I'm going to ask you the same question. I mean, looking at the bottom of a screen here, we're looking at 20 people to have been killed in the Gaza Strip, 9 of them children. And imagine if this thing gets escalated and you have more rockets coming from the Gaza Strip to retaliate against those that have been killed. But taking a look at the number of people being killed, it kind of is a very stark reminder of the way the Gaza wars have been, where you have this unevenness, the proportionality of the number of people being killed versus injured, especially on the Israeli side. Do you think that the U.S. is going to, and Joe Biden in particular, and his team going to look at this issue closer and place more importance on it?
I don't think they're going to do anything like that on the basis of sympathy or morality or anything like that. I think what they're concerned about is that a new uprising, intifada possibly, although, you know, no one can predict that, but that it can change the dynamics in the whole region. Palestine is very much the center of the region, and in terms of the thoughts and what people all over the Arab world feel about Palestine. So this is what the situation is. Of course, in Gaza has no air defenses. You know, it's like it's incredible that it's never presented this way in the U.S. media. But you know, the Israeli warplanes, many of which are provided by the United States, they don't face any danger when they carry out these attacks, these murderous attacks on people who are trapped inside Gaza, and that's the reality of the situation. It's really remarkable, I think, with all the oppression and repression that the Palestinian people have suffered for so long, they continue the struggle.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much for that. We had Monica Ndil, our correspondent, at the top of the debate, telling us the latest, also author and researcher. Daniel Jedrich, thank you, from Beirut, and author of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire. Richard Becker there from San Francisco. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mika Batawe, entire team here in the Capitol, to everyone, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره، همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafi. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, from the very beginning, I took care to help you to develop a noble character and to fit you for the life which you have to lead, to let you grow up to be a young man with a noble character, an open and honest mind, and clear and precise knowledge of things around you. Originally, my desire was only to teach you the holy book thoroughly, to make you understand its intricacies, to impart to you the complete knowledge of its commandments and interdictions, and not to leave you at the mercy of the knowledge of other people. But after having succeeded in this task, I felt nervous that I may leave you untrained and uneducated in the subjects which themselves are subject to so much confusion and so many contradictions. These are the subjects whose confusions have been made worse, confounded by selfish desires, warped minds, wicked ways of life, and sinful modes of thinking. Therefore, I have noted down in these lines the basic principles of nobility, piety, truth, and justice. You may feel them to be overbearing and harsh, but my desire is to equip you with this knowledge instead of leaving you unarmed to face the world where there is every danger of loss and damnation. As you are a noble, virtuous, and pious young man, I am sure you will receive divine guidance and succor. I am sure he will help you achieve your aim in life. I want to promise to yourself to follow my advice carefully.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. One of the very beautiful lessons which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is the lesson of generosity and the lesson of honesty. Now, beyond a doubt, even beyond a shadow of a doubt, we find in the historical texts in both the Shia school of thought and the Sunni school of thought that Imam Ali alayhi salam was the most generous person and the most honest man after the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. And now, how can one say that Imam Ali was the most generous man after the Holy Prophet? Well,